You're listening to Program to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica with your host, Jimmy Falun Gong. This is Premium Episode 4, Q&A 2, or JFK vs. U.S. Steel and the World Trade Center, Break Stuff. Now, we have a question here from Evan, last name redacted, that's right, forced OPSEC here on Program to Chill. Evan asks, a deep dive into the JFK versus U.S. Steel fight. Now, as of this episode coming out, my 12-part series on Krupp Steel has not been released. Needless to say, I have spent quite a bit of time and effort looking into the steel industry, although mostly the German steel industry, right? Still, I have perhaps a passing familiarity with U.S. Steel, and Evan, since you are asking about the JFK versus U.S. Steel fight, that means that you're probably familiar with the concept, but I will go over the basics for everyone, and then we'll get weird, okay? In President Kennedy's book, 7 Days in May, Kennedy had speculated about the three Bay of Pigs-type conflicts with his national security state before a possible coup. It's interesting, of course, that Kennedy was talking about the possibility of a coup. Certainly that has some bearing as to what happened to him, right? The author and researcher Jim Douglas lists out 7 conflicts. First, there was the Bay of Pigs, then the Cuban Missile Crisis. Third, we have the American University Address. Fourth, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. 5, we have the beginning of back-channel dialogue with Fidel Castro. 6, we have JFK's order to withdraw troops from Vietnam. And 7, there was the conflict with U.S. Steel. Now, any one of these conflicts on its own might not have been a good enough reason to kill a president, but all of them together? So as I go through this, a lot of this is going to be pulled from Jim Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. His chapter on it is a pretty good overview, if perhaps it's kind of surface level, and I don't mean that as a knock on Douglas. He had more than enough to deal with the overall assassination. He had volumes of information to wrangle with, so I'm not knocking him on not getting even deeper in Kennedy's fight with U.S. Steel. Also, separately, I'm not knocking Douglas again, but he is, if he has a flaw, it's that he's downright hagiographic about President Kennedy. I am not quite as keen on Kennedy, so I will try to temper out his praise and his historiography, right? So, here's the short version of the U.S. Steel fight. And I quote from the book. April 13th, 1962, President Kennedy, backed by overwhelming public support, forces the leaders of the steel industry to rescind a price increase that violates a Kennedy-brokered agreement to combat inflation. Kennedy's anti-business statements and beginning cancellation of the steel company's defense contracts makes him notorious among the power brokers of the military-industrial complex. Unquote. Douglas uses this as proof that Kennedy had alienated the most important elements of the military-industrial complex. And I more or less agree with him. It's hard to argue that Kennedy was not alienated from these elements, right? But let's get into it on a deeper level. To set up the conflict, before this had happened, before this conflict, Kennedy said that steel price increases would quickly drive up the price of everything else, which is correct. As president, John F. Kennedy helped broker a deal, which was a contract between U.S. Steel and the United Steelworkers Union. Part of this agreement involved U.S. Steel not raising their steel prices. Not raising their steel prices, of course, was important to the union and to the president, who did not want inflation because that, of course, would hurt his chances of being reelected. Then, almost immediately after this deal was brokered, U.S. Steel raised their steel prices by 3.5%. In other words, U.S. Steel double-crossed their steelworkers, and rat-fucked John F. Kennedy. Now, Kennedy needed those union guys to support him, and he didn't want to have to deal with inflation. So he was willing to fight U.S. Steel on this. Also, immediately getting punked like that would make him look weak, and, you know, he had only been elected the year before. So he needed to, you know, save face, I guess you could say. So he picked a fight. Or I guess you could say he was provoked into it. We'll discuss that in a second. But Kennedy, as part of picking a fight, Kennedy said to a reporter,
"My father..."
No, I can't do Kennedy voice, but... "My father always told me that all businessmen were sons of bitches, but I never believed it until now." Now, this ran in the New York Times. Which, I mean, he's telling the truth there, and it's funny, but that's also almost like throwing down the gauntlet, right? At the same time, Kennedy phoned the Steelworkers Union president and said, "Dave, you've been screwed, and I've been screwed." Then, after U.S. Steel raised their prices, the next day, Bethlehem Steel and four more steel companies raised their prices. Kennedy started to draw on every resource he had to fight this. He started with the Department of Defense. Kennedy had Defense Secretary McNamara start shifting steel purchases to the smaller steel companies that had not raised their prices yet. The Department of Defense's immediate steel contracts were worth over $1 billion in 1961 currency. Almost immediately, 9% of the steel industry's total business shifted away from the six offending steel companies, those that had raised their prices. The Department of Defense was prepared to buy some of their steel abroad as well. U.S. Steel and the steel industry was playing hardball in provoking JFK, but JFK was playing hardball back. And that's the thing, the Kennedys really did play pretty dirty. The Kennedys did go pretty hard when they wanted to. For example, the next thing that they did was they got the Attorney General, Robert F. Kennedy, his brother, and he convened a federal grand jury to investigate price fixing in the steel industry and possible violations of antitrust laws. The Department of Justice already had an investigation going in the antitrust division, but now RFK picked it up as a political weapon and threatened to bludgeon the steel industry. JFK ordered the FBI to start moving in and investigating steel executives. Later on, RFK was quoted as saying, "We were going for broke, their expense accounts, and where they'd been and what they were doing. I picked up their records and I told the FBI to interview them all, to march them into their offices, to march them into FBI offices the next day. We weren't going to go slowly. I said to have all the executives interviewed all over the country. All of them were hit with meetings the next morning by agents. All of them were subpoenaed for their personal records. All of them were subpoenaed for their company records." Along the same lines, Kennedy administration mobilized the Internal Revenue Service to start going after steel executives and their company's tax returns. This was war, basically, and it was getting ugly. Then President Kennedy went to the people directly, and he gave a speech on April 11th. Now mind the dates here, April 11th, 1962. And he said, "Simultaneous and identical action of United States Steel and other leading steel corporations increasing steel prices by some $6 a ton constitute a wholly unjustifiable and irresponsible defiance of the public interest. The American people will find it hard, as I do, to accept a situation in which a tiny handful of steel executives, whose pursuit of private power and profit exceeds their sense of public responsibility, and can show such utter contempt for the interests of 185 million Americans." In another speech, JFK said, "Some time ago, I asked each American to consider what he would do for his country, and I asked the steel companies the same thing. In the last 24 hours, we had their answer." On April 12th, Kennedy sent his lawyer mediator to U.S. Steel, and U.S. Steel asked if they could do a partial rollback of price increases by 50%. Would that work? Kennedy said, "I wouldn't say a damn thing. It's the whole way." JFK was willing to wage a full-on economic war. He was not willing to back down. On April 13th, Big Steel finally surrendered. The first to fold was Bethlehem Steel, and they were first because they found out that they were going to be cut out on critical naval contracts. Then U.S. Steel threw in the towel. The combined efforts of Kennedy's attacks and the public pressure was too much. Then all six steel companies rescinded the price raise. Start to finish, the whole incident lasted 3 days. President Kennedy won, but at what cost? Corporate hostility to Kennedy was now off the charts. Now let's talk about this. Raising steel prices was a decision that wasn't just made by U.S. Steel. Specifically, it was raised by the executive committee of U.S. Steel's board of directors. Which is a different thing, right? I mean, the board, you know, at the end of the day, that's who runs the company, right? Now, this executive committee of U.S. Steel included top-level corporate officers from financial institutions, including the Morgan Guaranty Trust Company, the First National City Bank of New York, the Prudential Insurance Company, the Ford Foundation, and AT&T. As a side note here, the Ford Foundation, by and large, I wouldn't say it's completely dominated by the CIA, but it works hand-in-hand with the CIA. AT&T has also done a lot of work with them. I don't know that that's the case for the other companies, but I would not be surprised. It's almost more the opposite, though. The CIA works for these financial interests, right? So, here's your program to chill life hack for the day. Don't piss off the upper tier of high finance and heavy industry. And certainly don't take or threaten to take billions of dollars out of their pockets. Not if you want to live to an old age anyway, right? Basically, what we've established is that high finance chose to have U.S. Steel provoke President Kennedy. But to what end? That is the question that was asked in an unsigned editorial in Fortune magazine. Fortune magazine, the editorial, asked why the financial interests behind U.S. Steel provoked JFK. I mean, like we've discussed, Kennedy could not have backed down. This was his first term. He planned to run for a second. He pretty much had to face Big Steel down in order to win. Now, Fortune's editorial suggested that the provocation was trying to propel an activist, anti-business president towards a fate like that of Julius Caesar. Interesting. So, this editorial was published in May 1962. The editorial was titled "Steel, the Ides of April." Now, that is an insane thing for Fortune magazine to publish. But let's talk about it. Fortune magazine was owned by Henry Luce, who is a friend to the Kennedy family. Some people have said that you could read this editorial as a friendly warning to Kennedy. Other people have read it as just a warning to Kennedy. Either way, I think you can pretty much take it for what it was, warning Kennedy. If you keep up with this, you'll end up like Caesar. And this is Fortune magazine. This is not like some rando publication. So here we have a situation where Kennedy is speculating on coups. We have Fortune magazine comparing Kennedy to Caesar. All of this, you know, before his assassination. Now, I've read the editorial. It doesn't sound quite as insane, you know, just on its own, pretending like Kennedy doesn't get killed like a year later, right? But still. Now, Robert Kennedy's Department of Justice, they kept up their antitrust investigation into the steel companies. And ultimately, eight steel companies were forced to pay maximum fines in 1965 for price fixing. Basically, these eight steel companies were doing price fixing between the years 1955 and 1961. And RFK's Department of Justice whacked him over the hand. Doesn't stop him, but it certainly creates quite a bit of problems for the steel companies. Then, the week after U.S. Steel surrendered, the Wall Street Journal published, and I quote, "The government set the price, and it did this by the pressure of fear, by naked power, by threats, by agents of the state security police." And other publications compared JFK to a Soviet commissar. So, everything I just said, it's pretty well-established history. Like, maybe some of my interpretations, you know, wouldn't fly with other historians, but I don't think I've said anything that is debatable or factually questionable. But, you guys want to get weird? Let's get weird. So, this episode will definitely come out before the free episode number 17. And in that episode, I go into greater depth about this topic that I'm about to discuss now. But basically, you know, British security coordination, which is to say William Stevenson's spying network in the United States. This network of people formed a company called the World Commerce Corporation. And on its board, there was William Stevenson, as well as his successor, Major Lewis Mortimer Bloomfield. There was also Sergeant Pepper, cue that music. There was David Ogilvy, the ad man. There was a whole host of suspect individuals. But there was also some pretty major players. There was Sidney Weinberg, who was the longtime director of Goldman Sachs. There was Nelson Rockefeller, John J. McCloy, and Richard Mellon, right? You following me so far? So the World Commerce Corporation was very interesting. They did some very unusual things. But they were liquidated in 1962 for tax purposes, quote unquote. Now, most of the same people in the World Commerce Corporation then went and formed a company called Permindex. Permindex had fewer of the aforementioned business executives, but it had all the same spies. But you know who else was on the board of Permindex? There were a whole bunch of sus people, but especially Roy Cohn, the Republican lawyer, and Joseph Bonanno of the Bonanno crime family. You know who else was on the board of directors? Clay Shaw, the likely co-conspirator involved in the JFK assassination. In the Oliver Stone movie JFK, he's played by Tommy Lee Jones. Clay Shaw was on the board of Permindex, and he went to Jamaica, where all the guys in Permindex were mostly hanging out. And he met with the board of Permindex several times in Jamaica in 1963, in the months, we're talking multiple meetings, during the months in the lead-up to the 22nd of November, 1963. So, I deal with all of this in greater detail in that episode, so I'm not going to go into it too much. But basically, long story short, Permindex was an international assassination firm that was run between the CIA, MI6, and Mossad. Now, why am I bringing this up at all? I bring it up because one of the other people on the board of the World Commerce Corporation was Edward Stettinius Jr., the chairman of U.S. Steel. He probably would have been on the board of Permindex, but he died too soon. We have a direct link between U.S. Steel and an international assassination bureau. Now, I don't think that Permindex was behind the plot to kill Kennedy, but I think that there was overlap between Permindex and elements that did kill Kennedy. So you see that it is not just a matter of U.S. Steel, the corporation itself, having clout and lobbying power and market share. U.S. Steel was owned by old money banking and insurance wasps, those vampires like the families that have run the country for 500 years, all that New England wealth. And the top tier of these people have ties to shadowy groups like Permandex. Like I said, I don't think JFK was killed for opposing Big Steel, but you got to admit that it did not help. That's my deep dive on JFK versus U.S. Steel. Another question here from Allie, who asks, also, I want to ask about hidden meanings and symbolism in the architecture of the buildings built at the World Trade Center after 9/11. especially the Freedom Tower and the Oculus transportation hub. Not sure if there is anything. I'll be honest with you, I'm out of my depth here on hidden meanings and symbolism in architecture. I'm relatively new to the topic of hidden meanings and symbolism in general. I never used to really believe in it when I would see, you know, NASA, like, moon truthers trying to find hidden meanings in NASA or the Pentagon. I always thought that stuff was a little kooky, right? It wasn't until I learned about magic, for better or worse, that I sort of came around to the idea. And of course, there's Freemasonry with the Founding Fathers. Kind of had to confront the fact that there is some of that some of the time, right? Now, I know that some people on Twitter have been doing very interesting work on the original Twin Towers design and the weird predictive programming that seems to have been a recurring theme through US media, perhaps implying an eventual attack. That's not my work. I'm very interested in it, but I'm also not conversant enough to repeat it anyway. But I will say this. The architect for the Freedom Tower, now known as the One World Trade Center, the architect is David Childs, who went to the Yale School of Architecture. And of course, there's the quite obvious One World Trade Center, which is certainly pregnant with meaning.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a new world order, a new world order.
Now, I will say that the Oculus Hub is very striking. Not necessarily saying it's good here. I'm not sure I care for it, but the architect, Santiago Calatrava, described the original design as representative of a bird being released from a child's hand. Which, wow, that sounds so peaceful, right? Though some critics have described it as a quiche stegosaurus. Now, I am very interested in the concept of psychogeography, though I cannot speak on it at length. Psychogeography was a concept developed by the Letterists and the Situationist International. All of those continental Europeans, right? Especially the French and Guy Debord. He defined psychogeography as the study of the precise laws and specific effects of the geographical environment, consciously organized or not, on the emotions and behaviors of individuals. Now, I would like to read more on this topic and related topics. I am only a novice when it comes to this stuff. But, one aspect that I have been obsessed with is the idea that shining objects actually have a psychological effect on the mind. The effect that they have is that they lower the mind's inhibitions in certain ways. Now, people have acknowledged this before, right? That is why slot machines are so visually overstimulating. It's why cars are chrome. It's why babies like to play with jangling keys, right? As well as, you know, certain types of video games, and maybe more esoteric, certain types of brainwashing involve flashing, strobing lights, right? Here's the thing. Now, through Suzanne Triester, the artist, who, you know, I adore her work, I can't speak highly enough of it, but in one of her books, she shows an artifact, a hypnosis lamp from Germany. And basically it's a lamp with a bunch of mirrors surrounding it. So you get sort of like a whole bunch of lights and you can stare at it and hypnotize yourself. Now tell me, what are UFOs like most of the time, if not floating, glowing lights in the sky? Just something to think about. Las Vegas itself was an experiment in this overstimulation effect. Because Las Vegas wants its visitors to lower their inhibitions for gambling and other excesses. Here's the real kicker. Since the 1970s, almost all business districts, at least in the US, and I know that this is a worldwide trend, business districts have been building buildings whose exteriors are nothing but giant reflective mirrors, essentially. Now, what kind of psychological effects would this have? Presumably the same ones, right? Lowering the inhibitions of those who work in fire and tech industries. Something to think about. When we get things like the One World Trade Center and the Oculus Hub, these too have psychological effects. All buildings have these psychological effects, and people study them. The only question is, what are these effects, and why are they trying to stimulate them? I'm not saying I have the answers, by the way. This would be a very fruitful field to study. Now, I can speak a little bit about the real estate deals involved with the new World Trade Center. I would like to research about the old World Trade Center as well, but I have not done it yet. But pretty early on, the decision was made to rebuild the World Trade Center in some form or other. The sheer logic of the market pretty much guaranteed that there would be some kind of rebuilding. And, like most money-making ventures in New York City real estate, the actual costs would be carried by the state. This decision was controversial at the time, and it's still controversial. For example, a full-page ad appeared in the New York Times, asking, "Why now is the government planning to pay for the construction of an overly expensive design to be occupied by government agencies at overly expensive rents, all at the expense of taxpayers' money, which could be put to better use? Why indeed?" But even the ad is perhaps leaving out the real story, which is that the state was paying for it, but pretty much giving it away to a company bidding, right? Let's get into it. So first we'll talk about who built the new World Trade Center, and then we'll talk about who owns it. The company that built it is a company called Tishman Realty and Construction. They built the first World Trade Center. They've also done tons of projects, including, of course, the One World Trade Center and properties co-owned by MetLife and Disney, which place it strongly in the financial networks of fire wasps, all the people that actually own everything, right? As far as who owns the One World Trade Center now, why, that would be the Durst Organization. Run by the Durst family. No, not that Durst family. The Durst family dates back to Joseph Durst, born to a Jewish family in Austro-Hungary in 1882. He immigrated to the United States in 1902, and supposedly when he came over, he only had $3 in his pocket. He worked as a tailor, and worked his way into becoming a partner of the dress manufacturer Durst & Rubin, located in the famous Garment District of New York City. Joseph Durst invested in real estate. He purchased his first building in 1915. After buying several more buildings, he formed the Durst Organization formally in 1927. In the 1950s through the 1970s, the Durst Organization moved into new construction and development. There's a long list of New York City buildings that they've either owned or built. I'm not a big New York City guy, so I'm not going to bore you with that. But Joseph Durst died in 1974. His son Seymour Durst took over. Seymour Durst is the asshole who came up with the National Debt Clock. And he continued investing in New York City real estate to great success. One of Seymour's kids, Robert Durst, is the serial killer featured in the HBO show The Jinx. Seymour's son, Douglas Durst, brother to Robert Durst, runs the Durst Organization today. In 2010, the Durst Organization bid and won the right to invest $100 million in the One World Trade Center development, becoming a co-developer with the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. The Durst Organization was bidding against a company associated with Goldman Sachs and another company associated with the Kuwait Investment Authority. So you know you're in good company, right? The Durst Organization's contract with the Port Authority gives the Durst Organization a $15 million management fee and a percentage of base building changes that result in net economic benefits to the project. The specifics of the contract give the Durst Organization 75% of savings up to $24 million and stepping down thereafter to 50% to 25% to 15% as the savings increased. Let's slow this down for a minute, because this is sounding a little bit like a massive giveaway to a privately held corporation. let's slow down just to make sure that that's not what this is. So to get this contract, the Port Authority required every bidder to put in $100 million to get an equity stake in the building and to agree to a 99-year contract, right? But to win the contract, the Durst organization differentiated themselves from the other bidders, all of whom offered a traditional flat management fee plus equity. The Durst organization offered a floating valuation where the value of the ownership won't be determined until 92% of the tower is leased or 2019, whichever came first. This was the trick, the floating valuation. That helped them win the contract. It's a tactic they've used in the past. I quote from a Port Authority commissioner named Scott Reschler, who says, "Really, the reason they were chosen was to leverage a credible private sector developer who would put skin in the game." By the time the Dursts stepped in, much of the tower had already been built. The Durst organization took a management fee for overseeing the last phase of construction. We mentioned before, that's the $15 million management fee, plus 75% of any cost savings up to $24 million, declining after that, right? So, long story short, they only had to put up $85 million, in other words. Then, under this deal, for the next 99 years, every time a new tenant signs a lease, the Durst organization gets 8 to 13% of the first year's rent. They've basically locked in a 99-year annuity, in other words. And they will definitely get their money's worth because the One World Trade Center is fully leased and worth over $2 billion. Over the long term, for the next 20 years, it's a very low return for us, says Douglas Durst, but we always have a long-term outlook. Now, much of this information I got from the Forbes article, Skyscrapers, World Trade Center is a risk for everyone involved except the Durst family, written by Aaron Carlisle, which, lol, Carlisle. Now, I know that this wasn't really what you were asking, Allie, but I gotta work with the skill set that I have. Thank you for listening. You're already on the premium side, so just tell people about the show. Thank you so much. And I gotta be on my way. I will see you next episode. And God bless. It's just one of those days when you don't wanna wake up. Everything is everybody sucks. You don't really know why. You wanna justify ripping someone's head off, no human contact. And if you interact, your life is on contract. Your best bet is to stay away, mother. It's just one of those days. It's all about the he said, she said bullshit. I think you better quit, let this slip, or you'll be leaving with a fat lip. It's all about the he said, she said bullshit. I think you better quit talking that fish. It's just one of those days. It's just one of those days. It's all about the he said, she said, bullshit.